Welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodrigues with you again. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for making Midday part of your day here on WYPR. What drives someone to commit mass murder? Each time a horrendous act of extreme violence occurs, the media seeks answers. It's hard to fathom the motivation behind such heinous acts, as we've seen in shootings in Connecticut, Colorado, California, last week or earlier this week in Nevada, this past winter in the mall in Columbia here in Maryland, last September at the Washington Navy Yard. Oftentimes, investigators look to external factors such as bullying, violent movies and video games. We've had congressional hearings on that subject. Poor parenting. Some killers are regarded as psychopaths. Today, we examine the role of paranoia as a factor in mass killings. Joining me to talk about this is Donald Dutton, a psychologist and professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. Donald Dutton has written extensively on the topic of extreme violence. He's the author of The Psychology of Genocide, Massacres, and Extreme Violence. And last year, he co-authored a paper on the subject of paranoid thinking in mass shooters. His paper was brought to our attention by Midday contributor Dr. Mark Comrade, a psychiatrist who joins us here on Midday from time to time. I want to welcome Mark Comrade back to the show. Nice to see you again, Dr. Comrade. And thank you for alerting our attention to this piece co-authored by our other guest, Donald Dutton, up in British Columbia. So, Donald Dutton, thank you for joining us here on the Midday show.
Yes, my pleasure.
Please tell us a little bit about paranoid spectrum. I'm going to start with that question because I used that phrase in the introduction to the show, mass killers and the paranoid spectrum. What exactly is the range in paranoia? Does it go from something as simple as not trusting someone to as extreme as having delusions about someone?
Well, the not trusting part is essential. It probably wouldn't include just not trusting one particular person, but it's kind of a mindset of mistrust in general at a low level, a non-psychotic level, and it increases gradually before you get to the psychotic end to people who become kind of preoccupied with the injustices that they believe have been done to them. And I'm emphasizing the they believe part here because actually, when you look back into their lives, you don't find as much evidence for injustice as they imagined. It becomes a kind of preoccupation with these injustices, and then that can also then lead to an active search for evidence for this disrespect or threat that's coming from other people. There's a preoccupation as well that there's the injustice involves some other group being favored when they are not, and we can talk more specifically about the particular mass murderers that we looked at who were in college. The other thing that kind of accompanies these preoccupations is a kind of unstated desire that these people have to be part of the favored group, but feeling like they are outsiders, that they're rejects. In many cases, they are. So there's kind of a jealousy that goes on, and they seem to be incapable of letting go of this mindset. So it's one thing I want to emphasize as well here is there's a rigidity in this mindset. It carries over for a long period of time. It's kind of a fixed way of looking at the world. It's not just an ephemeral, I don't trust this person over here, but they're locked into it and they can't let it go. And then as a result of this way of thinking, you have a person who also is very, very isolated, so they begin to spiral around with the thinking, and investigate what's going on to them, every time they sort of think it through again, it gets worse and worse and worse. And you can sort of track these things through in their diaries, which is what we did with a subset of mass murderers, that they keep talking themselves into a rage state, which is the final outcome of their reaction to this injustice. And so, you know, we looked at that with four particular mass murderers, all of whom had left diaries or websites, which allowed us to track their thinking over a period of time that preceded the shooting.
Mark Comrade.
Right. Hello, Dr. Dutton. Mark Comrade here. Thank you so much for joining us. Just kind of a way of background for our listeners, I just want to kind of clarify a little bit about this word paranoia. Paranoia in psychiatry is really a symptom. It's not a disease. It's not a diagnosis. It's not a clinical entity. It's a symptom, just like cough is a symptom of pneumonia. Cough isn't a diagnosis. And there are many different kinds of psychiatric conditions that include paranoia. Some of them involve, you know, some of the major mental illnesses at one end of the extreme and some more minor conditions. But paranoia really is a complex of thoughts and feelings that travel together in a certain fashion that involve how one sees the world around them and one's relationship to the world. And it's seen through the lens of feelings of persecution. And that lens can sometimes very much distort what you're seeing, exaggerate it, or cherry-pick the evidence, because really that pre-existing mindset, you know, we all have a mindset, and we filter the world through those pre-existing attitudes, and we can talk a little bit about where this particular mindset may come from. It's really, like most things, a combination of nature and nurture. But given those lenses with which you see the world, this particular symptom complex of thoughts and feelings can lead to some very characteristic misinterpretations that have to do with feeling that the world is against you, is persecuting you, and in when it starts to really get out of control, that persecution is deliberately designed to harm you.
I want to ask both of you this, and Donald Dutton, specifically a question for you about what the evidence is. And you made reference to diaries. I also see the word manifesto used in association with some of these mass killers. And the word manifesto comes up to describe writings left behind by the shooter in Las Vegas who allegedly killed these two police officers and another bystander in Vegas. Jared Miller up in Vegas. He posted a manifesto on Facebook in which he uses the language of the patriot or libertarian, decrying tyranny and saying that blood will have to be shed in order to combat tyranny in the United States. Also, a manifesto was associated with Elliot Rodger, who shot those people in California last month and wounded several, killed several and wounded several others.
And so, also Breivik over in Norway, thousand-page manifesto.
I guess what I'm getting at is maybe these manifestos existed before. Maybe they were handwritten or typed before in earlier ages. It just seems like getting at the evidence is, in a sense, easier today because it's out there. It's in social media. It's electronic. It's digital. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely true. People are, to a certain extent, playing to a crowd here. I mean, in a way, it may be their way of sort of getting what they feel is the unjust lack of recognition that they had up to this point, and now they're kind of getting it by posting a manifesto online. I mean, the four people we looked at had not so much manifesto. Well, Breivik was one of them, and certainly he had a manifesto. But the other three, who were Cho, the Virginia Tech shooter, definitely kept diaries and had a long sort of screed that he posted with a television station before he did the shooting. And Eric Harris had kept a fairly detailed, he was one of the Columbine shooters, he had kept a very detailed diary. And then Kimvir Gill in Montreal, who shot people, 20 people at Dawson College in 2006, he kept a website where you could sort of track his thinking. And I guess you could call it a manifesto. Sometimes we think of manifesto as having some sort of political overtones. Gill's didn't really have that. Breivik's did. I mean, he construed the whole thing in political terms where the threat was Islam and Islam's incursion into Norway. So he had groups that he sort of politicized the groups in his mind. And in his particular manifesto. But I think, the playing out to social media is a crucial part with some of these people. And then, I mean, Cho wanted his day in the sun. That's why he laid videotapes on a television station the day he was doing the shooting.
I have a question for Dr. Comrade, who drew our attention to the article written by, co-authored by Donald Dutton, our other guest, who's joining us by phone. What impressed you about the article? Is it convincing that there is this commonality of paranoia among these mass killers?
Yes. I think what was very interesting about this article and what Dr. Dutton has invited us to do is to look deeply within these people and to see certain depth psychology issues that they do appear to have in common. Now, a very important caveat here is, you know, most of these people who are mass shooters, we do not have them available for really personal clinical study. They've mostly died. It's one of the reasons these manifestos are actually quite important. You know, most of these analyses are retrospective post-mortem analyses, although with a manifesto, you may actually end up getting far more material than somebody might actually share with you if you had them live in the office interviewing them. So these manifestos can be quite important. But what Dr. Dutton has been able to bring out here is to turn our attention in a very important way to what's going on inside of people, because I think there's a tendency when these things happen to be looking for all of the social factors, all of the external factors, all the things that are wrong with our society, and the way in which, you know, civilization is going to hell in a handbasket that's producing these problems. And in point of fact, these are very, very vulnerable people that have been vulnerable for a long time and in a great deal of pain, and have some common ways of responding to that pain that causes them to descend into this rabbit hole, if you will, of thinking. It's this paranoid sense of being offended, feeling injustice, feeling alienated, and then beginning to start developing a myth and a set of stories that begin to justify revenge and ultimately move rarely, and again, these are very rare things, into violence.
Well, one of the things I hope we can talk about during the hour that we have with Dr. Comrade and Dr. Dutton is recognizing the threat, if that's possible, before it reaches this extreme point. But we're going to take a break here in a minute, our first break in the hour. We only take a couple of breaks, Donald Dutton. But I wanted to ask you about, to lay the groundwork a little bit for paranoia, you know, the conditions that would have to exist in order for paranoia, aggressive, real aggressive paranoia, to develop in a person who might consider turning violent.
Well, yeah, developmentally, I mean, you can never rule out the possibility of some genetic factor that simply hasn't been ruled out. The psychoanalytic view is that there's been some major disruption of trust early in development. That was Harry Stack Sullivan's view, that some of these issues came about interpersonally, and so you'd be looking back in the childhood to see if there's some evidence for that.
By the way, we want to claim Harry Stack Sullivan for ourselves. He was here in Baltimore at Shepherd Pratt Hospital, where I'm affiliated, so he's a Baltimore hero.
Direct descendants, excellent.
Thanks for mentioning that.
And I think that his formulations are really interesting, and to a certain extent, maybe not given as much acknowledgement as they should be these days, because he really looked at an inferiority developing in paranoid people as a result of this sort of disruption in trust fairly early on. And then that then causes a kind of cascade in thinking that we've talked about to a certain extent, that is this sense that self is being persecuted, that there's some blame, that it's deliberate, that people are, quote, out to get you, and that's where the paranoid that we think about comes into play, that people are out to get me.
Okay. Anything else there? What about some mental illness, severe depression?
Well, I mean, I guess you could say that obviously there's sort of a systemic progress here in the paranoia, but I think paranoia itself might be a form of mental illness.
Well, it's a symptom of a number of mental illnesses.
You said, that's why I asked. Dr. Comrade said it's a symptom of a mental illness.
And there can be various illnesses. So, for example, there can be schizophrenia, for example, and that paranoia starts to become increasingly delusional, sometimes with, you know, bizarre thoughts, not just people hate me and, you know, they're trying to deliberately afflict me, but even more bizarre thoughts like Breivik, you know, who thought he was going to be the next king of Norway.
Right.
You know, many strange and unusual, grandiose delusions in certain people. And again, each of these people is different in their own way. What we're trying to do here is, though, to look at some of the common themes.
Right.
And so there are manic paranoias. There are schizophrenic kind of paranoias. There are drug-induced paranoias. Each one kind of has its own flavor. And by the way, I just want to say that with regard to Harry Stack Sullivan, look, people can develop paranoia even with a normal upbringing. I mean, there can be broken brains that deteriorate into paranoia, so it's not necessarily always traceable to something that went awry in childhood. You know, that was an old idea, is that mental illness all traces back to something that goes awry in childhood, and sometimes that's so, but that's not always so. You can have a perfectly normal childhood and then have the, as Dr. Dutton was saying, the expression of a gene, such as, for example, the genetic vulnerabilities for the onset of schizophrenia, characteristically between age 18 and 21, mm-hmm. which is when it's most likely to manifest. And you can have an unraveling despite having had a normal childhood. But at the end, what's going on internally, I think he has charted the landscape and what he's calling this cascade of things beginning to fall.
And I guess one of the questions we'll examine, or at least talk about in this hour, is a little bit, how do you stop the cascade? How do you stop the unleashing of this violent attack that, keep it from reaching that extreme point? We'll take a break here and come back and talk some more. And we'll invite calls from our listeners. The Midday Show, you can reach us here at 410-662-8780. If you have a question about anything that we're discussing this hour with Donald Dutton, professor of psychology. He's at the University of British Columbia, an expert in extreme violence and violent behavior. We're talking about paranoia and mass killers. Also with us today, of course, Dr. Mark Comrade, psychiatrist based here in Baltimore, author of You Need Help, A Step-by-Step Plan to Convince a Loved One to Seek Counseling. 410-662-8780 is our number for your questions. Our midday email address, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here with Dr. Mark Comrade. Joining us from Canada, Donald Dutton, a psychologist, professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Comrade told us about an article that Donald Dutton had co-authored on paranoia and paranoid thinking in mass shooters. So we're taking a look at that today because it does seem like this is becoming the new normal in the United States to have mass shootings. There's been several of them lately.
I think we need to be careful about that. It's not the new normal. It's been far too many than we would like, but they're still extraordinarily rare. And people would say that, you know, far more people get killed on the south side of Chicago in a week.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, an extraordinary event where you have, in California, for instance, 7 people dead, 13 wounded in one incident. That's why we talk about
these
things.
They are extraordinary.
People feel extra vulnerable to something like this, Dr. Comrade, because they happen in group settings. They
Absolutely.
Happen on campuses and schools. And yeah, I mean, the new normal means, to me, it means it's becoming more frequent.
Although one of the reasons that that increased vulnerability, it's natural, of course, to feel vulnerable when you hear these things. But it sometimes, you know, the media plays and replays and replays and studies and restudies, and people can get re-traumatized. I mean, it's bad enough when you first hear it come out, but mm-hmm. when it's, you know, all the news all the time about it, which is one of the reasons why I was particularly intrigued with one particular radio station up in Canada.
A television station.
Let's talk
about this, since Don Dutton is joining us from British Columbia. I hope he's heard about this. I've just caught wind of it this morning. Dr. Comrade heard a report about it on NPR just last evening and drew our attention to this TV station in Canada that has decided to what? Stop?
Well, they specifically, there was a shooting up there recently.
In Moncton.
Mass shooting. Right. In which the television station, the editor, really did some homework and looked at some of the research that's out there about the contagion effect of reporting both on suicides and on homicides. And they made this decision, which they announced in this 2-minute editorial on the air, that they did not want to disclose the name of the shooter. They wanted to kind of do their part in keeping things more sober.
Lower the temperature of the thing.
Mm-hmm. And specifically, this reporter cited evidence, and maybe Dr. Dutton can speak to this, about how shooters sometimes very much identify with past shooters. They study them. It's many of them, they've been finding lists of names of past mass shooters, you know, among the effects of somebody who's just recently done a shooting. I know there's a video game out there where you can play Columbine Shooter, and one of the shooters was known to play that. So they wanted to do their part in this Canadian station with not putting that name out there and not putting a lot of specific details about this person's life. To not add to the list of infamy that they felt might infect those who could be tottering on the edge. What do you think about that, Dr. Dutton?
Well, everything that you said is accurate. I mean, I think it's true that there are a number of cases that we looked at where mass murderers had been studying previous mass murderers, and somehow they wanted to top them, you know, or do one better. So I think with this TV station up here, what they were trying to do is to focus more on the victims and to sort of drop information about the perpetrators in general, including names and identification. I mean, it's an issue because obviously the news wants to give the information to the public, but on the other hand, you don't want to give people something that they can sort of play to.
Well, let's just talk about it for a minute. I'm thinking about it as a news person. I come at it differently mm-hmm. than a psychologist and a psychiatrist do, but... why does the public want to know what the motivation was? And I know it's complex. The answer is complex, and we don't always know because of privacy issues. We don't know fully the details of a psychological examination that might have taken place 4 or 5 years earlier. What we have are these manifestos. In the case of Elliot Rodger, a 137-page document that he left behind called "My Twisted World," which the media got its hands on, a video that was made available. And you talked about the Virginia Tech shooting and videos that were made available. So all of that stuff is out there. And are you suggesting that it would be wise for the media to hold some of that back from the public?
But probably not realistic in the sense that, you know, even if there was general agreement on this, there would be enough people who would not necessarily subscribe to that restraint that the information would get out anyway.
I was going to say to Don Dutton up in Canada, this TV station doing its part to lower the temperature and all these things after a mass killing and for the benefit of victims in particular. However, you can turn to another TV station perhaps and get all the information you want about the shooter.
So pragmatically, maybe they didn't accomplish much, but I think they were trying to at least make a statement.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact of the matter is how things are reported can sometimes be detrimental, both in terms of traumatizing to the victims and those people who worry, could this happen to me? And can be inflammatory and inspiring depending on how you report it. So it's not about whether, it's about how.
What I hope would come out of this hour, and we can talk about this with Don Dutton and Mark Comrad, is, you know, the warning signs, sensing the threat, seeing the threat, recognizing it, and what we could do about it to keep this from happening as frequently as it's been happening. 410-662-8780. I'll get to those questions during this hour of the show with Don Dutton and Mark Comrad. Let's take a call right now. Matthew in Baltimore joining us with a question for our guests. Welcome to Midday.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question for your guests. My understanding is that, in general, violent crime has decreased over the last 20 years for the United States per capita, and media coverage to some degree would have us believe that, as you said, the frequency is on the rise. Some of that's probably due to the media just focusing on issues and events that we would normally discount anyway. But looking at these particular individuals who are paranoid and, as you already said, are a very small percentage of the population, is this subset on the rise? Is overreporting making it seem like they're on the rise? Or is this a greater or lesser risk than it was, say, 10 years ago?
Don Dutton or Mark? We'll go to Don.
I don't actually know that it's on the rise. I mean, I certainly agree that it's a very small percentage. I mean, mass murders are high-profile events. They're high-profile events because they make the public feel that they could have been a victim. Who's getting shot is just not someone in a criminal situation. It's someone who's going to college or walking down the street. And so it's got sort of direct impact on all of us, and that's why, and plus the fact there's a number of people that get killed, they become high-profile events. And, of course, we always overestimate the frequency of high-profile reported events because we see them in the media so often, and underestimate, conversely, the ones that go less reported. So, you know, I don't know about the actual incidence increases. I mean, some of the ones that we're looking at date back to the 90s, and before that we didn't see quite so much of it. You know, I think if there is a new issue, it may be this new issue about social media and people playing to social media and some of the killers in these cases.
Yeah, can I ask
had
you about
one eye on how they were going to be remembered in social media?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you about that because it's interesting because on the one hand, we have these people that are very detached and alienated, disconnected and uncoupled from society. In fact, that's part of their problem is they feel rejected by the in groups and so forth. But then they can often tap into social media, such as websites like Stormfront, which Breivik was tapped into.
Well, this fellow in Las Vegas just posted his manifesto on Facebook.
Right. So. And my sense, Dr. Dutton, is that the difference in a way between terrorists and these lone mass shooters is that terrorists identify with the group and consort with the group and participate in the group and even plan with the group, whereas these paranoid individuals, almost by the definition of paranoia, don't belong to the group.
Right.
They're incited, they're inflamed, they're inspired, they're juiced up by what they may read on these websites. Would you agree that's a difference?
Yes. Yes, I think that nails it. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the things that struck me about the mass shooters that we were looking at was how preoccupied they seemed to be with not being part of the group. Like they wanted to be, but they didn't know how to do it, and they were enraged that this group didn't accept them and that someone else was getting the favors. Jocks and preppies is what Kimvir Gill called them, and Cho had the same notion of these jocks and preppies, this popular group of boys at college. And it looks like Elliot Rodgers had that as one of his groups on his hit list as well. So they wanted to be like these guys. They were jealous of these guys, and they were enraged that the other guys were getting the goodies, and they weren't. And they were acting absolutely alone. And, you know, I mean, with the exception of the Columbine killers, who, you know, were a duo, but by and large, these guys are definitely lone wolves.
You know,
I just wanted to say something about my comment earlier about the new normal and what I'm concerned about. I'm not a clinician, but my concern is the availability of weapons to people who suffer from these conditions.
Yes, although,
and,
you know, weapons have always been around. How about that fellow who slashed through a school with a knife?
We have high-powered firearms available to people today. We have liberal gun laws in the United States, and especially in the states where we see these shootings occur. So that's why, and for the reason Don Sutton cited, that these shootings occur on college campuses, yeah, in schools, on streets where people are, you know, buying sodas. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's a concern about it.
Well,
I agree with that. And I also think, you know, we had a shooting in California that I've mentioned now a couple of times. We had this Las Vegas. It sounds like an execution in Las Vegas of police officers by somebody who reportedly has delusions about the tyranny of the state. I guess manifest by a couple of cops buying pizza. And we had a shooting again the other day in, was it Seattle or Oregon? In Oregon.
Both, actually.
One in Seattle and one in Oregon on a school
camp. Oregon yesterday and Seattle last week.
So there's a bit of a 10-car pileup for me in my mind about what's going on here. So.
Sure. And by the way, as you know, I always like to take the opportunity when you bring up guns and mental health to remind the listeners that the big story about guns and mental health isn't mass shooting or homicides. It's suicide, which is three to 10 times that two out of every three human beings that die at the business end of a gun, it's their own finger on the other end of it. Mm-hmm. And that's actually the real story
People are still surprised to hear that. We've used that number a number of times. And people are still kind of shocked when you tell them about the two-thirds.
It is shocking. And, in fact, the suicide rate is, in most states, at least three times the homicide rates, with a few exceptions. You know, about the new normal, though, I have an interesting thought about that. I think that there are, as the term that's of art lately is memes, cultural memes that begin to emerge in a society that become part of the collective consciousness, unconsciousness, and so forth. I think one example of that that we saw, you know, and become sort of an epidemic kind of the trajectory is suicide bombings, right? Suicide bombings up until the mid to late 20th century, you know, were relatively rare, and then it began to grow epidemically. And now, you know, it's a tool that's used all over. Mm-hmm. I think there is a possibility that there is emerging through our increasing knowledge and exposure to this through the media and social media and so forth, a meme that could be emerging about ways of people expressing this paranoid outcome, that outcome is now in the collective consciousness. And I think that we may indeed be seeing an epidemic rise. I hope not, the way that we've been seeing that with suicide bombing. What do you think, Dr. Dutton?
Well, I think that's a distinct possibility. I mean, one would hope not. But I think just for the reasons that you outlined, yes, there are definitely are some trend lines. And yes, the suicide bombing thing has begun to have a demise. It's definitely decreased compared to where it was 15, 20 years ago. So, you know, I hesitate to use the word epidemic because, as you pointed out, all of these things are relatively rare events. But in terms of just the sheer frequency, there certainly are peaks and valleys.
Right.
Well, let me just interject a little bit of politics here, because I have an email from someone who addresses this point that I'm going to read on the air. And I've thought about it myself, too. Polls indicating in the United States, anyway, Don Dutton, I don't know how it is in Canada, increasing mistrust of the government, increasing concern among gun owners that guns are going to be confiscated, especially during the Obama administration. And we see the rise of the Tea Party and in the political rhetoric, lots of references to Big Brother and the government being some sort of omnipresent and coming to take your guns away or to spy on you. It's a whole big mixture of things that seem to be aimed at the government as the enemy. And the word tyranny is just one step away from that. You hear this a lot in the patriots speak of the Tea Party in particular, for instance. The email here from one of our listeners, Frank, in Hampstead, Maryland, who says, in regards to paranoia, we as a society should look at our mass media for the far left and right. I am thinking of Fox News, where they glorify the rancher Bundy for his stance against the federal government, when they wanted to confiscate his cattle, which were illegally grazing on public land. What mass media is essentially saying is that it's okay to go against the government that is obviously oppressing their citizens. Then you are feeding the paranoia of individuals that then go out and attack society. And I know there's quite a leap from there to actually someone with a diagnosed condition of paranoia
and
shooting.
And what we're talking about here are shooters who are not specifically targeting. These aren't political acts or terroristic acts that we're focusing on today, you know, where you blow up the government building or you go in and you shoot a bunch of government workers or, you know, even something that's, you know, very, very specific to a calculated victim. Most of these mass shootings that have to do with these psychiatric disturbances really are whoever you can get your hands on in the neighborhood, on the street, in the campus.
Yes, that seems to be true. But the rhetoric, Don Dutton, maybe you want to refer to this or respond to this. The rhetoric that's there all the time, it seems almost constantly that, you know, the government is out to get you or government is going to do something bad to you. And that comes up in this manifesto. Maybe I'm influenced by having just read this thing from this fellow in Las Vegas, who aimed all his animus toward the government against these two police officers, Don Dutton.
Right. Yeah. Well, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, just ask about the situation in Canada. The killing in Moncton, New Brunswick, last week, the guy was dressed in battle fatigues, had semi-automatic weapons, and killed three police officers who probably were symbols of the government to him in some way. The difference, I think, is that we don't have militias, as far as I know, in Canada. In the U.S., does have right-wing militias. And so that, you know, there's sort of a step upward there. I mean, and this whole sort of issue about, you know, is this Timothy McVeigh sort of reincarnated here with these guys that are acting out this sort of rage against government oppression? I think there's a general feeling of powerlessness that these people have. How they construe the powerlessness in terms of who they see as being the enemy group or the group that's holding them down, making them feel powerless, keeping them from getting what they think they deserve to get, that's something that seems to vary a lot on an individual basis. And, of course, with some of them, you get the powerlessness is defined solely in sort of campus terms. And then with others, it gets broader to the government is doing this to me. Or in the case of Anders Breivik, you know, it was the left-wing government in Norway that was letting all these Islamic people come into the country, and so they were the enemy. And so he went to their youth camp and killed all their children. This is the kind of swirl of, you know, the power dynamic that seems to swirl around in the minds of mass shooters.
Donald Dutton, that's his voice, Donald Dutton, speaking to us from British Columbia. He's a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia, co-author of an article on paranoid thinking in mass shooters, published in Aggression and Violent Behavior, a review journal. His article brought to our attention by Dr. Mark Comrade, our other guest who's joining me again here in Studio A, a contributor to Midday. We're going to take a short break. We'll come right back and take phone calls, questions for our guests at 410-662-8780. Yeah, interesting discussion here on Midday today. Dr. Mark Comrade joining us again. His book, by the way, is You Need Help, A Step-by-Step Plan to Convince a Loved One to Seek Counseling. And so much of what we talk about on the air comes down to that, doesn't it, really? Identifying problems in people, maybe yeah. as a relative or something, and trying to get them help.
Yeah, in the best-case scenario, my book is designed to try to head off and prevent these kinds of tragedies.
Let's go to the phone lines, take some questions, and then we'll come back to that question I want to get to with our guests, recognizing the threat of paranoia, extreme paranoia, leading to possible violence, and what you do about it. George in Baltimore, we'll go to you first. Thanks for calling.
How you doing?
All right, George, what'd you want to say?
I just want to say that I believe that the this paranoia is fed by political parties, and they move these people several levels beyond where they should be. Again, if you know, take your country back, and you're being treated unfairly. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that with people I know. I mean, one day they're listening to Al Sharpton, the next day they listen to Rush Limbaugh. And they're going in two directions, making them, giving them, you know, people to blame.
Well, it is true, and we talked about this already a little bit, that there is some politics in some cases, but in a lot of these other cases, it's far more random and doesn't seem to be based on politics. In the case of Elliot Rodger in Santa Barbara, California, from my watching of the video and his manifesto, it had to do with his, maybe you want to talk about this, Don Dutton, his rejection by women generally.
It seems to be whatever is salient in the mind of the shooter. And for the ones who are in college, what's salient to them are the college in-groups, and that's what seems to be really capturing their thinking. And
although you do point out, though, that sometimes the objective evidence really is not as severe as the subjective perception of these people.
Oh, that's true.
And that,
that's
you know, and which is why I want to say about the other caller, you know, you can blame political parties, you can blame this and blame that, but the problem is that in a certain kind of unbalanced mind, you know, anything, you know, you can say, well, you know, we made, you know, a beach ball, that we have, you know, a really nice day of at the beach, and, you know, there are women walking around scantily clad, and that's what caused somebody to go off. So they will feed on all sorts of psychological food that to a more balanced mind may not be digested in just that same way.
Here's another call. I'm sorry, go ahead, Don, and then we'll take another call.
Okay, yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I mean, I think, you know, for me, what made that particularly true is when I was reading about Eric Harris at Columbine, because they portrayed him as being a victim of bullying, et cetera. But when you actually get into reading the biographical descriptions of him, very little evidence for that. It's more what he made of it.
Huh. Ananda is our next caller. Go right ahead, please. Welcome to Midday.
Hello, Dan. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to asked panelists about the influence of social media on this kind of epidemic events happening, and people giving manifestos and even sometimes giving warnings and indications that they are going to react in a violent way. And what can we do to sort of prevent this using the information and manifestos or sorts that are released ahead of time to prevent this kind of incident?
Very good. That gets to the question I wanted to tackle here, Don and Mark, comrade Donald Dutton, recognizing the threat, what to do about it?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things. I mean, it is problematic detecting these things ahead of time. I mean, just to give a couple of case examples, Eric Harris and Kimber Gill were both living at home with their parents, and all the parents seemed to realize in either case was that they were somewhat withdrawn. Eric Harris had a prior mental health assessment, and they said he had an anger problem. They put him into anger management. Well, what he had went way beyond anger management. So, I mean, if all we're seeing is isolation, we're not going to do anything. But if the person's got a website going where there's hateful messages in the website, then that is something that we should be paying attention to. Now, that gets into the whole sort of thorny area of privacy and sort of the assessment of websites, you know, and looking at websites and then making some kind of policy-based decision about it. And, you know, the issue always kind of comes back to, well, we can't really do anything until the person has broken the law. And even if you have a hate-filled website, it might not be anything that's actionable. So it's an issue. And then there's always more hate-filled websites than there are by far people who act out based on the beliefs that they have. It's a complicated issue, and actually I think probably Dr. Conrad, since he's written a book about it, can tell you more about it than I can.
Yes, and so I don't want to say that nothing can be done. The fact of the matter is I actually think that the primary interventions really do need to begin in the family. You know, the title of my book is How to Help a Loved One Get Psychological Help, Counseling. The fact is that, you know, Harris was not always at that ultimate level where he acted. There were some years leading up to him to that where he was in a more accessible state, mm-hmm. where earlier intervention might have aborted it. So, you know, I don't know specifically about that case, but you said, you know, we really can't do anything when all we see is that he's isolating in the basement. Frankly, I think that that is a very important warning sign, and that is a sign for a family to be concerned and a family to act and try to either convince through, you know, rational conversation if possible, and if not, to steer the family member towards getting a proper psychological evaluation early.
I'm glad you're saying that. We had a discussion just a couple of weeks ago about teenagers, the teenage brain, in fact. And I would think a lot of parents may be of the mind that, well, my son is going through his adolescence, he's going through his teenage thing, and they tend to be isolated loners and self-centered and all that, and I've got to let him work through that and just sort of leave him alone there in the basement or in his isolation, because they believe that's sort of the normal track.
And the fact is, it's not one sign. In the book, I talk about some of the constellation of things that often travel together that are warning signs of an incipient mental illness. You know, spending time in your room by itself does not constitute that, but a change in your grades, a change in your ability to participate in doing your homework, a change in your level of socialization with your friends, mm-hmm. A change in vegetative functions like sleep and appetite and weight changes. These things travel together. Then you're beginning to see a syndromic phenomenon here that really calls to at least ask the question, what's going on here, and going to somebody that might help you to be able to answer that. And that person might, and you know, at the end of the day, say, I think this is normal adolescence. You know, let's keep an eye on it, but I'm not that worried about it.
Here's another call for, I guess, Eddie in Westminster. Go right ahead, please.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So actually, that was a great lead-in to my question. Seems to me like if you look at the do a root cause analysis on a lot of these shooting situations or violent situations in public. You can sort of narrow the root cause down to some sort of mental health issues, just like is been talked about in politics recently, but there's nothing being done about that other than maybe bans on guns or that sort of thing. Basically, the way my question is, or what I'd like to pose to the panel is, what would you think about in the school system changing sort of the culture of our class system? What we have now is a standard math, science, reading culture. We don't have any standard classes on behavior or mental health, and why not integrate that into the school system all the way from elementary school through high school in the United States?
Interesting question.
Well, you're really preaching to the choir on that one. I agree completely that, you know, social engineering, I think, is a very much a missing piece in school curriculums, and preventative mental health by teaching children skills of conflict resolution, skills that can enhance emotional resilience, mm-hmm. Skills at developing cooperation. I think that
taking on bullying,
and you know,
there's been a lot of talk about that.
Absolutely, how to handle bullying, and even how to support peers under these circumstances. This, I think, is very critical in education.
Don Dutton, you want to address that?
I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I may be less optimistic that it's going to filter through to the kind of people we're talking about here, because they tend to see this problem as not their problem. It's a problem because some group is acting badly towards them, and so they're not really amenable to mental health. It's the old issue, how do you get someone to make use of mental health services when they don't think they've got a problem, when they're externalizing the blame for the problem? That being said, I'm totally in favor of having social engineering courses as part of a curriculum. I mean, to
right.
me, that's
because
really a no-brainer.
For public mental health, you know, the far more major problem are depressive disorders and anxiety disorders and suicide and so forth. If you want to make an impact on public health, that's what you aim for, not aiming with some technology that's going to prevent mass shootings, which are so difficult to prevent.
Hey, we're down to our last minute and a half here or so. A question came in from Brad in Baltimore wondering if in the U.S. we're uniquely paranoid. Are we uniquely paranoid in the United States? There are other countries that have this kind of problem. And the case studies that are cited in this article by Donald Dutton, Catherine White, Dan Fogarty, Paranoid Thinking in Mass Shooters, covers you've been referring to Kimvir Gill. He was a shooter in a Canadian case, right?
Right, yeah, and Breivik was in Norway.
Breivik in Norway, and Cho at Virginia Tech, and Harris at Columbine. So those are the case.
Right.
This is not a statistical study. This is a case study looking at paranoia.
That's right. I mean, and these, in fact, are a subgroup of mass shooters because they're ones who left manifestos or diaries. So we don't even know they're representative of the ones who don't write about it. But so there's no attempt here. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of the actual numbers, there probably would be more mass shootings from the U.S. per capita. I'm not absolutely sure of that because you got a population of 300 million people.
Mm-hmm.
But it does seem a little bit higher. You can look at other indicators. I mean, you can look at the reaction to 9/11 and the anxiety that developed in people, and whether that anxiety is anything that could be described as paranoia.
Well, you know, mental illness, unfortunately, goes all the way back through recorded and pre-recorded human history, and, you know, will probably be with us for a long time and will manifest itself in every age differently.
Dr. Mark Comrade, thank you again for being with us today. We're out of time. I appreciate you being here. Dr. Mark Comrade, a psychiatrist based here in Baltimore, author of You Need Help, A Step-by-Step Plan to Convince a Loved One to Seek Counseling. Thank you very much. And thanks for bringing to our attention this article by our other guest, Donald Dutton, who joined us by phone from British Columbia, where he's a professor of psychology at UBC. Thank you very much, Don Dutton. Nice to have you on the show.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
and thank
it.
You, everybody, for tuning in. That's our first hour of Midday. We'll take a break here for lunch, brought to us today by Breathe Bookstore Cafe in Hamden, and we'll see you for the second hour of our show.